Tom Secker is a British-based writer and filmmaker. He is the founder of SpyCulture.com, a blog and podcast which you can also support on Patreon. His latest book is National Security Cinema, The Shocking New Evidence of Government Control in Hollywood, which I just finished reading. Good to have you with us, Tom.
Hi, Roy. It's good to be talking to you. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Now, I've been teaching U.S. politics for a while and have used as reference material work by Trisha Jenkins and Oliver Boyd Barrett with their books such as Hollywood and the CIA, which discuss how the U.S. government, namely the Pentagon, DOD, CIA, and NSA, influence and manipulate Hollywood. There's not a lot of material out on this subject, and I've always thought the Hollywood-Pentagon connection to be much worse than it seems. And finally, your new book, National Security Cinema, proves that. You describe how there is a wealth of documented material which is squared away in the private library of historian Lawrence Swede, which we don't have access to right now. And you mention one author, David Robb, who somehow obtained access to these papers for a short period of time and published Operation Hollywood in 2004. Can you tell us first, before we get into some of these examples, the difficulties in researching the subject of how the government manipulates Hollywood and blockbuster films?
Well, like you just said, one of the main problems, at least with the DOD, is that there is a large amount of material in this private archive in a library in Georgetown. The archive is maintained by Lawrence Swede, and he has written several books on this topic, but nothing since 2005. And as a result, all of this stuff from, goes up to roughly 2003, that's our understanding of it. So it covers decades of the DOD's involvement in Hollywood, what changes they made to scripts, what it is that they negotiated in or out of these films in exchange for their support in terms of filming locations or access to people and vehicles and so on. So that's probably the biggest problem, is that when you FOIA the Pentagon, when you file a Freedom of Information request with the Pentagon for this stuff from pre-2003 or so, there's very, very little of it left because it's all been handed over to Lawrence Swede. But he won't let anyone in to look at that archive because the only time anyone's been able to do that, they wrote a very critical book, David Robb's book that you just mentioned, a book that's very critical of the DOD's manipulation and censoring film scripts. But that was in 2004, and I've been working since 2013-14 with an academic called Matt Olford at Bath University, who has written on this for years. And we started thinking, well, let's at least have a stab at this. Let's at least try and get some of the stuff since then or whatever records are actually available. So we coordinated and I filed dozens of Freedom of Information requests. But there again, you have a problem of a lot of the stuff gets destroyed. For example, when I asked in 2015, I asked each of the entertainment liaison offices for each branch of the military, I asked them for whatever records they had, whatever office reports they had for the previous 10 years. Now, the Marine Corps provided me with about 7 or 8 years worth of reports. The Army provided about 5 years. The Navy still won't release their records to me. The Coast Guard still haven't released their records to me. And the Air Force released only a couple of years worth of reports and said, oh, we don't have anything from before that. We don't have anything for 2015 at all due to computer failures in the office. Yeah, right. Even the very direct and persistent approach with the Freedom of Information Act has only yielded a patchy record. Now, fortunately, that record is enough to show dozens of examples of politically motivated changes and censorship of film scripts and TV, for that matter, and music videos and a few other things. But the point is, there's so much more out there. There will be more in Swede's archive. There will be more in the various other archives within the Pentagon. It's just a case of trying to get access to them, and that's not easy.
It's a very interesting field of research, and it's good to see people like yourself getting into it. A 1941 Senate investigation, as you write in your book, called Hollywood gigantic engines of propaganda. What would be the most accurate and factual way to describe this relationship between Hollywood and Washington? Do we say that Washington controls Hollywood, manipulates Hollywood, influences Hollywood, and are the films outright propaganda, or is it more nuanced because a 1943 OSS memo, the precursor to the CIA, describes motion pictures as weapons of psychological warfare? So how would you best define this relationship?
Now, there's a good question. I'd say influence, probably, because it's not... I mean, films, plenty of films, most films, in fact, get made without any support from the government. The ones that do, the amount of influence that the government agency has ranges quite considerably, depending on the agency and depending on the circumstances of their discussions and negotiations. So it's not like a Soviet or Stasi or fascist style state censorship bureau where they're simply going in there and saying, you can only make this sort of film, you can't make that, you have to make this. It's not like that. It's very much that the filmmakers want what these agencies have. And quite often that's expertise and knowledge that the filmmakers don't have. Because when it comes to things like the CIA, their main cinematic asset, because they don't have fleets of ships and, you know, 1,000 Air Force bases and all the rest of it, their main cinematic asset is simply that they know lots of cool stories. They know lots of secrets. They know lots of times when people have tried something and it's backfired, or, you know, they can provide a lot of drama to screenwriters. So in exchange for that, they can wield quite a lot of influence. They can say, okay, we'll tell you a dozen different things and you can pick the three best ones that fit with your script. But in exchange, we'd like it if you changed that and took that scene out, or maybe changed that character so that he wasn't a CIA character, but instead was a civilian character, a politician or whatever. So, yeah, I would characterize it as influence, but sometimes that does edge towards control. On some productions, they've had massive influence.
And you say that this Washington influence or control in Hollywood increases the support for government institutions, which isn't bad per se, but perhaps increases it to an extent where citizens will view the government in such a positive or cool light so as to let it get away with wrongdoing. And we've seen plenty of corruption and wrongdoing in CIA actions overseas, NSA, domestic surveillance, and so on. This propaganda seems to increase the support for the security state. And you cite how up to 30% of people who viewed CIA propaganda-infused films having changed their opinions favorably towards the government. Can you speak a little bit about what effect these films have upon us?
Yeah, sure. Well, that was from an academic study conducted a couple of years ago. And, I mean, the problem is, with the Pentagon, they've supported, by our estimate, over 800 Hollywood movies over the last century or so. So how do you actually add up the effect of that? It's very hard to quantify it, right? Because there's so many other factors affecting people's opinions of the government in terms of news coverage, in terms of social pressures, in terms of the sort of general systemic pressure to sort of don't, you know, speak out, just kind of go along with the system and you'll be all right. But this study looked at the short-term effects. They basically surveyed a bunch of people, asked them what they thought of the government, what they thought of different departments within the government, even more general questions like, do you think the country is going in the right direction? And they found, when they surveyed them after watching Argo and Zero Dark Thirty, that their opinions were dramatically more positive. And not just of the agency portrayed or agencies portrayed in the film, but of the government more generally, of the direction of the country, of even of specific departments that don't appear in the film. They thought better of them after watching the film. So we can only guess, you know, we can make an educated guess that if in the short term you can affect 30% of people's opinions or thereabouts, in the long term, you can probably affect more people's, a greater percentage of people, because different films will appeal to different people in different ways. So we can only assume this does have quite a profound effect on people's willingness to let the government get away with, like you say, corruption. But at times we're actually just talking about crimes, plain and simple. So, you know, I mean, kidnapping someone and torturing them is a crime. I don't really see that it makes much difference. It's the CIA doing it. So things like that, it's the Edward Herman, the guy who wrote the book with Noam Chomsky on the propaganda model, he said that the role of major media is to normalize the unthinkable. And I think that probably applies to Hollywood even more than it applies to news coverage, because Hollywood has so much more emotional investment. It has, in many ways, a lot more relevance to people's real lives than news coverage about some economics conference going on in Switzerland or whatever. So, yeah, I'd say it has a quite profound effect on people.
And now let's look at some examples. You give numerous case studies in your book of the manipulation of Hollywood. Let's first talk about some very slight or nuanced examples of Washington manipulation. For example, you mentioned how the Pentagon refused a request to lend equipment in Jurassic Park 3 to kill a dinosaur because it would make the military look bad. And then another one in Nicolas Cage's Wind Talkers, a World War II film where the government altered the script so as to prevent giving a bad image to the U.S. Marines, even though some parts of the film were historically true and accurate. Can you talk a little bit or give some examples of these very subtle or nuanced low-level manipulations by Washington?
Okay, I mean, you're right. A lot of this is quite subtle. It's not propaganda slapping you in the face. And to be honest, Hollywood seems to do reasonably well at that, even without the government's involvement. But okay, on Wind Talkers, one of the scenes that they didn't like is where a Marine, a Marine uses the bayonet on the end of his rifle to prise a gold tooth from a dead Japanese soldier's mouth. Like prize a gold filling out because, you know, it's worth money. They really didn't like that scene, and that had to be eliminated from the script in order for them to agree to support the film. And there is some historical evidence, possibly even film footage of this sort of thing happening, but there are certainly accounts of this happening. And so therefore, it's not a question of accuracy. It's just a question of they don't think that makes them look very good, and they don't like the political subtext of their soldiers being kind of mercenary brutes. So, yeah, like I say, that had to go in order for them to support the film. With Jurassic Park 3, so the producers approached the Pentagon. They approached Phil Strub, the main Hollywood liaison, was interviewed about this. And he said they came in with a script whereby they wanted to borrow some A-10 gunships, like flying gunships, and they would battle with pterodactyls in the movie. And Strub's response was, no, we can't do that, because gunships will just, they'll just tear through those creatures. It won't be a battle at all. It'll just be a massacre. And people will feel sorry for the dinosaurs and kind of hate the military. So that scene was just eliminated from the script. And that's, as silly as it sounds, that is a form of censorship. That is something they wanted to put into the film, but they couldn't because the military wouldn't let them. At the start of the film, there is a character who actually discovers the Jurassic Park island full of dinosaurs. And in the original script, he was a military character. So they had that changed. They said, just get him out of the uniform, make him a civilian character. So they did. And then Strub goes, well, and how about at the end, rather than portraying the military as, you know, the slaughterer of innocent dinosaurs, why don't we have a nice rescue scene at the end? The military can turn up and rescue the people on the island. And so they wrote that into the script. And as a result, the military's role in that film, from the original script the producers came in with to the one they actually ended up making, the role was completely reversed.
And that makes that really changes the dynamic of the story and what otherwise, might have been a more interesting film. Let's look at some more heavier or serious cases where the Pentagon pretty much, I don't know if we can go so far to say, created a propaganda film. You mentioned Transformers, which seems to be a film where, in a way, the military literally took it over. It's funny, one reason I decided not to watch Transformers was how it seemed to be obviously drenched in war pornography, as they say. And this was before I was fully aware of this relationship between the Hollywood and Pentagon. You also discussed TV shows like NCIS, where in one episode, the script, the storyline involved military personnel making biological weapons illegally. And this is something that actually has a basis in fact and was written about by international lawyer Francis Boyle from the University of Chicago, who is also the creator of the UN's Biological Weapons Convention. He mentions how the Pentagon has illegal laboratories in Africa where they make biological weapons for warfare purposes. And then the Pentagon eliminated that NCIS storyline and changed it where they were trying to cure Afghanistan war syndrome. What are some more deeper or obvious examples?
Well, I mean, there are dozens of them, but I guess one of the ones that we found really striking when we discovered this was on the film Enemy of the State, because we knew that the CIA were involved in this, and you could watch that film and read it as a kind of CIA attempt to bash the NSA, to kind of have a go at this rival agency. That's why they supported it, was because the CIA do not appear in that film in any way, and the NSA, or at least some of the NSA, are the bad guys. But we discovered NSA emails and an article that the NSA actually helped to write in the Baltimore Sun, where that the producer Jerry Bruckheimer was interviewed about the film, and he said that in the original script, the operation to chase down Will Smith and run this massive surveillance and murder campaign was like an NSA operation, a kind of fully acknowledged and authorized operation. And that got changed so that it was just one rogue agent, one bad apple within the NSA who was running this, because they didn't want to implicate the entire agency in this. And for the purposes of the story, it doesn't make much difference who's running it. So that is a politicized change where the blame for crimes, the blame for malfeasance, is placed on an individual's shoulders or a small group. It's never that there is some kind of institutional problem. It's never that crimes are just being overlooked by this agency. It's never that there's any kind of systemic or ideological failing there or anything like that. It's just, oh, it was just a small group of guys who went bad. And that kind of thing, that turns up in a lot of storylines about the intelligence services. And in a lot of cases, we don't know what changes were made to these films. We only know that the agencies worked on them. So we do wonder, in, for example, in Charlie Wilson's War, a film about the Soviet-Afghan War and the CIA's operation to fund the Mujahideen, in the original book, you discover that this congressman, Charlie Wilson, the guy who was raising all this money to fund the Mujahideen, that he was actually a CIA asset, that he was recruited by the agency, and that the guy Gust, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, it was actually his handler. You don't get any impression of that in the film. It's just, oh, he's just good time Charlie. He's just this hard-drinking congressman who likes fun and women and wanted to help the Mujahideen kind of thing. So you do wonder, with some of these changes, were they made specifically because of the CIA's request or the NSA's request? In a lot of instances, we don't know. In the instances we do know, they're very, very deeply political. I mean, let me give you another example from Lone Survivor, which is based on a true life story, a real US Special Forces operation. And essentially, they dropped four Navy SEALs onto a mountainside in Afghanistan, and they were supposed to be finding and assassinating a local Taliban leader. The problem was, while they're on the mountainside, they get discovered by three goat herders, three completely innocent people, And they have to decide, well, what do we do with these guys? Do we tie them up and leave them to freeze to death on the mountainside? Do we shoot them? Do we let them go and risk being discovered by everyone else? And in the end, they let them go and they get caught by the Taliban. Three of them end up dead and one of them makes it out. And he's the guy who wrote the book and hence Lone Survivor. But that scene with the goat herders where they're deciding what to do was substantially changed by the Pentagon. In the original script, which is based on the book, the four of them openly discuss this being a war crime. But they're not really scared of going to jail. They're more worried about being castigated by the liberal media, as they see it. And it's like, well, you've committed a war crime. I mean, be castigated. That's kind of fair enough in my book. They do constantly consider this possibility. They take a vote on it. In the scene with after the Pentagon had rewritten it, it's basically they kind of talk about it. They say, well, no, because we'll probably go to jail. So they don't do it. So all of this stuff about the politics and the liberal media and actually openly admitting that you want to commit a war crime, that all got thrown to one side. That all got removed from the film. And this is supposed to be based on real events. And let's not forget, the Pentagon says that one of its main reasons for being involved in Hollywood is accuracy, technical and historical accuracy. Well, in that example I just gave you, they threw out all the technical and historical accuracy and just had the scene rewritten to suit their PR objectives.
And what are some examples of films that were not made because the Pentagon in one way or another prevented it? I believe one was the sequel to Tom Cruise's iconic Top Gun, which is finally going to come out, I think, either this year or in the coming years.
Yeah, sure. That was one that got delayed for about 20 years because it was going to be made in the early 1990s. But there was this scandal called the Tailhook Scandal, where a bunch of Navy officers basically went on a drunken rampage, smashing up a hotel and sexually assaulting people. And this was partly blamed on the so-called Top Gun effect. They thought they were somehow copying the Top Gun film. So when the producers of Top Gun 2 came in and said, oh, we want to make the sequel, they said, not right now, you're not. And so it didn't get made. It got shelved for the best part of 20 years. And it's only now that we're seeing that they're actually kind of pulling it together. And, over 20 years, I guess, that they're actually making that film. There was another one in the 1990s called Countermeasures, starring Sigourney Weaver, that essentially one of the main reasons they didn't want that film made was because it made explicit references to the Iran-Contra scandal. And as the Pentagon saw it, they had no reason to remind people of Iran-Contra or embarrass the White House like that. So that film just never got made. And again, it's not a Soviet-style censorship bureau, but it is censorship. It is cultural censorship. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
And knowing that what we know about these levels of propaganda or censorship that are targeting audiences, targeting us, how should you and I, we handle these films? Should we watch them as we usually do? Because they definitely will alter our opinions through their subtle and subconscious, sometimes overt propaganda. Should we shun them altogether? Or should we try to enjoy them knowing full well that they are jam-packed with pro-war propaganda?
Well, I guess there's two different schools of thought on that, maybe. Probably more than two schools of thought, to be honest. I would say watch them, or if you are going to watch them, just try not to take them at all seriously. Try not to let whatever the propagandistic elements in the film are into your mind, and don't make them part of your opinions about the world. And if you just want to watch them as frivolous entertainment, then to be honest, they're pretty harmless. If you are going to consider, does this film mean anything? And if it does, what does it mean? And what is its relevance to the real world? Then I suggest, certainly with important films, with big films that make a big impression on you, look up whether the government was involved in them. Go and have a look on IMDb or have a look on my website and see if there's any information about this. Because in a lot of cases, there is. You can find out at least which films they worked on. So that will give you a better I don't know, a better reference point, a better way of delineating between the stuff in the film that you should take seriously and the stuff in the film that's probably propaganda. Because I don't think getting everyone to just watch films and say, oh, Hollywood's just full of propaganda, that just takes the joy out of it. That takes the enjoyment out of watching movies. And I don't want to start preaching at people and telling them to do that, because I love movies myself. And actually, in some cases, not that many of them, but in some cases, some of these propaganda movies or movies that have been propagandized are actually pretty good. And some of my favorite movies, ones that I would actually really enjoy watching and watching again. And some of them are complete dreck, like Battleship. But yeah, I don't want people to stop enjoy watching films. I just think, like I say, either ignore all the political elements in them and just enjoy them as frivolous nonsense entertainment, or take it seriously and try and figure out which of these films are propaganda and which of these films just have a bit of political stuff in the script.
And what about, for example, this new film that's coming out with Tom Cruise portraying Barry Seal, who was a pilot who flew drugs for the CIA, so it's a true story. But it's kind of unprecedented that there's a film coming out talking about this, although it seems to be a total spin by the agency to make it look, you know, comical and cool, according to the trailer. What's your thought about that?
It probably will trivialize the story. It might be a bit like Air America. You remember Air America from, I think it was about 1990 or so?
Yeah, Mel Gibson and was it Robert Downey Jr.?
Yeah, yeah. And that kind of portrayed some of that world. But we've also had, a couple of other things have broken in the media in the recent years. We had Kill the Messenger, the Gary Webb story, which I think is a fantastic film and very accurate and very kind of hard-hitting. There isn't really much you could criticize that film on at all, to be honest. And we've also recently had a History Channel series somewhat looking at this that's interviewed people like Doug Valentine, who've written on the subject of CIA drug smuggling for years. So it is a subject that's finally finding its way into mainstream media, not in a big way, not in a noisy way, but I'm not sure about the Tom Cruise Barry Seal film. I honestly don't know which, if any, government agencies were involved, but it would surprise me if there wasn't any, partly because it's Tom Cruise. I also think it's directed by Doug Liman, isn't it, who has worked with certainly the CIA he's quite friendly with, and I think he's worked on Pentagon films as well. So I would suspect it will be a softballing of that topic. I'm guessing it won't be as hard-hitting as Kill the Messenger was, for sure.
Yeah, I really loved Kill the Messenger. In fact, in some of my classes, when we go over 20th century world history, we discuss the 1980s and the Cold War. I've actually shown the film in its entirety to some of my classes. It's really good. I know you've focused on Hollywood and Washington, and you can't really compare Hollywood industry to the film industry in other countries. It's the biggest in the world. But to what degree does this same sort of thing happen in other countries? Do you have any knowledge of that? Because, you know, China probably does similar things related to its films. Do you have any idea?
I'm not sure about the Chinese domestic film industry. I do know that they're quite heavy-handed when it comes to censoring imports. Like, there is a scene in Men in Black 3 where people use the flashy thing that erases people's memories. They didn't like that scene because they thought it would make people in China think of government censorship and mind control. So that scene had to be cut from the version that was shown in Chinese theaters. So that's a slightly different dynamic, in as much as that's an imported film that they're saying you can only show in, you know, this format, in this cut, in this edit. In this country, we do know of some instances of dramas and documentaries that have been censored or sabotaged by the intelligence agencies or otherwise by the government. Most of this goes back to the 70s and 80s. The problem is we don't have anything more up to date, because the up-to-date documents aren't in the National Archives yet, and the Freedom of Information Act in this country doesn't work as well as it does in the US. But we do know of instances where the military have cooperated on a long-running TV serial or a film and said, no, you can't have that storyline, or no, you have to change that bit of dialogue. So it certainly does happen in Britain. I can only guess it does happen in China, in their domestic industry. I'm not sure about other countries, to be honest. It would kind of surprise me if you're talking about major countries that have a big reputation on the world stage, and therefore they see cinema as a means of spreading a good reputation about themselves. I'd be surprised if they didn't do it at all. I don't think anyone has quite as sophisticated and formalized a system as the United States does, though.
You mentioned in your introduction how there remains a vast amount of material and documents to sift through, and you felt that this information needed to get out now, which is one reason you published this book recently with your co-author. What opportunities and challenges do you think lie ahead in uncovering more in this field of research?
Opportunities? I guess the biggest opportunity is that there is an archive of materials from the Marine Corps, who have had a very, very active role in Hollywood for lots of years. They have an archive that comprises around 90 boxes of different folders, which contain script notes and draft scripts with their annotations on, and communications with the filmmakers and contracts and all sorts. And we only have a small smattering of that stuff that I've been able to prise loose through the Freedom of Information Act. And to get all of that would probably cost $20,000, maybe even more. However, I do wonder about crowdfunding that, whether it would be possible. And if we could, I'd happily, you know, just stick it all up on my website and let people have it all for free. So that's one opportunity, because that would provide us with much more data, basically, than we have now. We have quite a lot now, and an awful lot more than we had 3 or 4 years ago. And that's partly why we published the book, is we just said, we do actually have a huge amount here that just no one's written on before, even quite a lot that David Robb never wrote on before. So that would be the biggest opportunity. The biggest obstacle, the biggest problem is, I suppose, that the Freedom of Information Act is an imperfect tool at best. And like I say, that they seem to destroy an awful lot of these records. I mean, I filed dozens and dozens of requests and managed to only get, a couple of dozen sets of script notes and communications out of them that have actually been able to let us determine in a lot of detail what it is that they've done to a certain movie or TV show. So, yeah, I think that's the biggest problem, actually, is that under the way that government administration works, after a certain number of months or years, they just destroy it and it's not there for anyone to get ever again.
And any final thought or comment on this field of research, this connection between Hollywood and the Pentagon, the CIA and NSA, is there any, or something you want to reiterate, any takeaway for us?
Well, simply that we now have an enormous amount of hard data, of hard evidence, basically irrefutable evidence, of this influence. We know how it works. We know how the process works. We understand the dynamic between the filmmakers and these agencies better than we ever did before. So I'd encourage everyone to go and get the book. If you've read other books on this topic, or even if you haven't, you'll probably find it quite accessible. We went to considerable lengths to try and make it accessible to people who weren't familiar with this subject beforehand. So, yeah, please go and get it, National Security Cinema. But also understand that this is a subject that has been, a lot of speculation has been made about it, and an awful lot of people have just denied that it's even a problem. So we now have at least a solid record, a paper trail, that demonstrates how all of this works. So if you want to know the facts, the reality of the situation, and you want to get away from the argument and the speculation about it, then you could do a lot worse than get a copy of our book. I suppose the only other point is that I'm this isn't over for us at all. I'm certainly going to continue podcasting and writing and publishing documents and things on this on my site. So we are trying to get more information. We're trying to flesh this out even more than we've been able to already.
And your website is spyculture.com. You have a Patreon as well where people can support you. Indeed, as you said, people should go out and purchase National Security Cinema. They can do so in ebook, digital, Kindle version, or the paperback, hardcover. And how can people best follow you and support you and your work?
Well, like you say, they can sign up via Patreon. They can subscribe to the podcast that I do, Clandestime, which you'll find on spyculture.com. And you can sign up via email, RSS, various podcasting apps, iTunes, all the rest of it. So if you do want to hear more about this, if you do want to follow my work or support it, then go to spyculture.com. It's all there.
All right. Thanks a lot for this interview. I will never look at Hollywood movies the same way again.
Thank you. It's been good talking to you.